Hello, and welcome to Physics Frontiers, episode number 52, Sterile Neutrinos. Show notes for this episode can be found at frontiers.physicsfm.com/52. Show notes include the papers that we discussed in this program, as well as links to related Physics Frontiers episodes. And now, Jim and Randy.
Okay, how's it going, Randy? What's going on?
Jim, it's good to hear from you. Today we're going to talk about sterile neutrinos.
Sterile neutrinos. What is a sterile neutrino, Randy?
All right. So we all know that neutrinos are incredibly weird because back in 98, they discovered that the neutrinos coming from the sun were oscillating. So they're changing from one form of neutrino to another form of neutrino to another form of neutrino on their way to the Earth, which is just bewildering. So now, particle physicists and cosmologists are looking at the idea that there may be another type of neutrino that's different than the three that we know about, the electron neutrino, the muon neutrino, and the tau neutrino. Then there may be a kind of neutrino which only interacts with other neutrinos through the weak force and with gravity, but not with anything else. Or rather, through mixing. It's through mixing, right?
Yeah, it's through mixing. It's not through the weak force. So the whole point of the sterile neutrino is that it does not interact with the weak force, and that's why you can't see it.
But it does have an impact on like the ratios that they're seeing in, what is it, short baseline neutrino detection experiments?
Well, yeah. For the first paper, I think he was talking about that a lot, and they showed up in the other two, but the whole idea was for these reactor experiments and these disappearance and appearance experiments, you have a short baseline that's a short distance between oscillations. Do you remember what that distance was?
I don't. I know that it was pretty short, like on the meter scale, I think.
Yeah, so it was on the meter scale, not on the 20,000 kilometer scale like the regular oscillations. And so they were looking at those things, and they said we have to have these really massive neutrinos. Maybe they don't have to have it, but one way to explain that is that you have these massive neutrinos that are sort of in the neutrino mix.
Yeah, so they oscillate into that form on rare occasion. That's the idea. So that's why that's how they're explaining away like the 5 or 6% discrepancies they're seeing in those experiments.
Yeah, it has to be very rare. Part of that is because the oscillation frequency is related to the difference of the square of the mass. You know, these normal neutrinos are less than 170 millielectron volts. If you add up the normal neutrinos, their mass is less than 170 millielectron volts. And this other guy has to be somewhere around one electron volt, at least for the kinds that they're talking about in the first two papers. In the third paper, they get really, really massive. But, I mean, as a comparison, an electron has a mass of about one half of a mega electron volt, about 500 kilo electron volts. So these guys are like 3 million times, 30 million times, something like that, less massive. And then with all of the different constraints, the heaviest of the normal neutrinos, of the active neutrinos, they call it active because it interacts with the weak force, the heaviest of those could be 70 millielectron volts. That's the maximum mass it could have, because that 170 millielectron volts is a maximum size or a maximum limit for the sum of the three. It could get down to as low as about 59.5 millielectron volts.
Wasn't that first paper, the first article, didn't they talk about a sterile neutrino with a mass of like 1.7 electron volts? It was like a range between like 0.6 and 1.7 electron volts, I think.
Well, yeah, they've got two different experiments, the appearance and disappearance experiments, and those should have about 0.6 electron volts squared. And the reactor experiments should have a mass difference between the smallest neutrino, the lightest neutrino, and the new neutrino of 1.7 electron volts squared. And when you take the square roots for both of those things, it gets closer to one electron volt for the mass. And that lightest neutrino probably doesn't matter very much at all, because the lightest neutrino at maximum could be 50 millielectron volts or 1/20th of an electron volt in mass.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
All I did was I took all of the information that they gave me and I found the limits for each one of the neutrinos. And the lightest one has a range from 0 to 50 millielectron volts. or actually a little bit lower, around 49.5 millielectron volts. And then, you know, the other ones have their other ranges as well.
And those are all inferred, right? Based on the probability of them shifting from one form into the other, right?
Yeah, and I think they do that by looking at the Z width. The width of the energy line for the Z boson.
Yeah, because neutrinos interact with the Z boson, the W boson, and I think they also interact with leptons, like the electron, right?
Neutrinos?
Yeah.
Yeah, the regular old neutrinos show up in electron decays, and that's how the weak force was first postulated. And the neutrino was first postulated, was because there was a little bit of a problem with the energies, with the old reactor experiments, with the old bubble chamber experiments. They postulated that something was going on with a neutral particle. Yeah, I'm going to screw up the history, so I'm going to shut up.
Well, let me ask you this, because this is a question that I didn't see answered in those papers, because I should have done some deeper digging. But is there a difference between the electron neutrino, the muon neutrino, and the tau neutrino other than their rest mass? Like, do they have a difference in their properties or anything?
Yeah, I mean, they don't have charges and anything else. So they're just neutrinos that show up with interactions involving, like, the muon and the tauon as well. Maybe it's just a tau particle, I don't know.
Since the only difference between them is the rest mass, then isn't it more like there's, like, one type of neutrino there that's changing its mass?
Well, that's what the oscillations say.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Is that don't the oscillations suggest that the neutrino, all three flavors of neutrinos are just a neutrino in three different states?
Well, I mean, that might be one way to look at it. I don't think that's the way they think about it. My feeling is the oscillation is just weird, because what happens with the oscillation is you have the three real neutrinos, which are nu1, nu2, nu3, and then you have the three neutrinos we actually see, which are the electron neutrino, the mu neutrino, and the tau neutrino. The real ones are the ones that satisfy all the fun symmetries of, you know, the standard model and stuff like that. And the ones that we see are some linear combination of those things. So it's a superposition of those three different things. And that's sort of what all that mixing angle is about.
And that's where all that talk about coherence and incoherence came in, right?
Yeah, in that paper, he was saying...
Let's give the name of the paper and the author, too, because we usually do that so people can follow along.
Yeah, we completely forgot to tell everybody that we read something.
A bunch of stuff, like a few articles in the popular press, plus some papers that were published.
Basically, what's happening is if the mass difference is much smaller than your uncertainty in the square of the mass, then plane waves are okay. You basically end up with a very long wavelength. And if you have that very long wavelength, you can just assume that it's a plane wave. But if the uncertainty is on the same order of your mass difference, and it's about that 1 to 2 electron volts squared area is where the uncertainty is, you no longer have this thing that looks like a plane wave, and you have to look at wave packets because your neutrino is more localized. And then if you have something that's really, really massive, and that'll show up in the cosmology stuff, that means your neutrino is going to be very localized and you aren't going to see any oscillations.
Another question that came up while I was looking at this was, it seemed like they were suggesting that the oscillations aren't just like a random statistical thing as much as it seemed like they were saying that the neutrinos were interacting with either W or Z bosons or some other particle between the sun and the earth in order to oscillate. Are those oscillations being driven by an interaction, or is that purely a probabilistic function?
My understanding from this is that it's probabilistic.
Because they called it quasi-probabilistic, which made it seem like it was just the probabilities were just falling out of like ambient interactions, maybe. That's what I was thinking anyway. There's not really any space that neutrinos can travel through where they're not going to have some level of interactions, right? Otherwise, like, how could a neutrino go from, like, a smaller mass to a larger mass if they didn't somehow get that energy from some kind of interaction, right?
The uncertainty principle may be sufficient for that.
But that means that we might be talking about an interaction with the vacuum expectation value of the energy in the ambient space, maybe? Like, quantum field fluctuations? Because isn't that how the uncertainty principle works in other models, where it basically borrows energy from the vacuum and then gives it back? All right, so I thought it was more particle based, like they were encountering, you know, bosons or something in space.
I don't think that can be true, Oh, well, maybe that is true. Maybe that's why they oscillate. But, I mean, they're saying that even though these guys don't interact with the W and Z bosons, they still...
Okay, I was just talking about normal ones.
They can still oscillate with the other ones. So if it, they can still oscillate, right,
mm-hmm.
with the other active neutrinos. Mm-hmm. That was the idea.
Right.
As I understand it. And if that's happening, and the steril neutrino can't interact with the W and Z bosons, then it can't be caused by the weak field.
But they all have mass, right? So they all have to be interacting with the Higgs field, right? And that has a specific vacuum expectation value, right? So maybe that mass oscillation has something to do with its interaction with the Higgs field.
Possibly. They spend a lot of time talking about the Higgs field in here, but I wasn't always sure exactly what was going on.
Yeah, it's a tricky subject. The neutrinos are so unbelievably weird. And then to throw on top this possibility of steril neutrinos, it's like, holy smokes. Because this is a whole other ballgame. I mean, at least with most of quantum physics, you have discrete particles that remain discrete particles. I guess quarks do some kind of oscillations too.
I generally just look at it as an idea like we don't look at the world right.
Yeah, the world was way freakier than we normally think. But at least normally, like, electrons stay the same. You know, you think, you know, certain particles decay, like the muons that come into the atmosphere. I mean, they all have an identity, and when they decay in very specific ways. You know, only I guess the neutrinos and quarks, the only ones I can think of off the top of my hand, that do this weird oscillation thing where they change from, like, one basically flavor to another, right? We should talk more about the steril neutrinos. So the accelerator experiments, or the reactor experiments, I should say, are indicating that there could be the presence of these steril neutrinos with a rest mass of somewhere around one electron volt in that, you know, mass squared term. But cosmologically, they're looking at steril neutrinos with a much larger mass, with like 3.5 kiloelectron volts, right?
Well, they're seeing a line at 3.5 kiloelectron volts. They're saying that the neutrino has to have 7.1 kiloelectron volts as its mass to see that line during the decay.
Oh, okay. So the neutrino decays?
So what happens is the steril neutrino oscillates back into an active neutrino, and that active neutrino is excited, so it emits a W or a Z particle. I don't remember which one. And that Z particle then splits off into two more neutrinos. That's the signature that they're looking at in that 3.5 kiloelectron volt line. Now, I guess that's the explanation for the line. So the line came first and the explanation came later, but that's how they're interpreting that line.
So they're seeing the photons with that much energy. Is that right? The 3.5 kiloelectron volt photons?
I don't think you get a measurement of the neutrinos. So eventually those have to turn into photons.
Okay, so that's what they're thinking might be a dark matter candidate, right?
That's what they think is a dark matter candidate, although it's really, really heavy.
Yeah, that is way heavier than the reactor experiments are indicating. But on the other hand, cosmologically, like, you know, you see cosmic rays with tons of energy too, right? It's way higher than anything we produce in a reactor. So I wonder, if there's some mechanism cosmologically that could explain the presence of those high energy neutrinos. Like maybe, I don't know, black holes or something create a really high energy neutrino. I don't know. They got to be coming from somewhere, right?
I mean, they may not be neutrinos. So this is just a way to turn neutrinos into, I guess what they're calling it is a warm dark matter candidate.
But I thought that it was only like a hot dark matter candidate if they had the really low, like one electron volt rest mass, but that it could emulate the findings they're seeing, which is like a cold dark matter thing, if they were much more massive, because then they'd have, what, less kinetic energy, right?
I think that's why they called it warm. So at some point in one of these papers, I think it was the one we're talking about, which is...
No, the role of steril neutrinos in particle physics.
Yeah, the roles of steril neutrinos in particle physics, which is a review article by Sin-Kyu Kang, who's in Korea. Yeah, and yeah, so I think that's the reason why they made the distinction between hot and warm, right? Because nobody likes hot dark matter anymore.
Yeah, that can work. Because it wouldn't clump, right? If it was hot, it wouldn't clump around the galaxies like we're seeing. Is that right?
I think that's one of the reasons. I mean, there are a lot of reasons why
it couldn't be bought.
The whole idea about dark matter was to explain galaxies' stability. And so, I mean, that would have been one of the first things to go into the theory. So maybe after a while, people decided it didn't work. But probably there were a lot of other reasons that went into that.
Well, I just think, I mean, if they were hot and they, you know, if they were really moving fast enough, then they would have enough kinetic energy. They'd have the escape velocity, right? So they wouldn't gather in a nice cloud around galaxies, right? They'd just fly out all over the place in space like photons.
Possibly, but I mean, at the time that people decided that, you know, neutrinos probably weren't the thing, they were still hoping that they were going to be the Majorana particles or something and be completely massless and wander around and travel at the speed of light and all those other fun things you get to do when you have no mass.
So I remember when dark matter first came out, the first.
No, you don't.
Well, I guess when it was being popularized in the press in the 90s, it seemed like our best explanation at that point probably was something new, like a neutrino, because it has to be something with like virtually no interactions other than gravity, and there has to be an awful lot of it. So this kind of brings that idea back to life, because even though your regular active neutrinos can't fit the bill, these sterile neutrinos might do it.
I don't think it ever really disappeared since the first idea about sterile neutrinos showed up. I mean, this first sterile neutrino showed up in like 1968 or something like that.
Oh, I thought that our first real indication that these babies existed was after that experiment that ran from like 1990 to 1995, where at like Los Alamos National Lab.
Well, I think that's the first time people thought they really needed them.
Oh, I see. You're theorized before that.
I think there was a guy in Russia in 1968. Yeah, I'm not going to try to pronounce his name. Who first theorized them, and I think he was actually known for other things as well. But there was no need for them, and it's one of these things where you're saying, basically, here's this thing that you'll never see, and it's really important. So that's a great theory, but you know, we probably want to look for something that is a little more testable. Then later on, they find out there's some deficiencies. And once you find out there are the deficiencies, then you start worrying about things like that.
Yeah, you're missing something, right? So there's also this weird, they call it tension, which is a nice word for it. Tension between the appearance and disappearance arguments for the sterile neutrino. So apparently they've got strong appearance indications, but they have like counter disappearance evidence.
So yeah, I mean, the first paper actually seemed to be pretty good with both of them. The first paper being
Sterile Neutrino, A Short Introduction.
The one I'm thinking about as the first paper is the one that basically started off people looking at sterile neutrinos as a really strong candidate, at least in this particular cycle, which was, are there sterile neutrinos at the electron volt scale, by Kopp, Maltoni, and Schwetz, and that was in 2011. The other one that you're talking about, the sterile neutrino, A Short Introduction, by Naumov from 2019, and that's just going over the things that people sort of know. And sometime in between there, or maybe it's just a personal judgment, but sometime in those 8 years, it seems like there was a falling out with the disappearance data, because Kopp seemed to be pretty happy with using the disappearance data to try to fit his 3 plus 1, 3 plus 2, and 1 plus 3 plus 1 theories about the sterile neutrinos. Basically, he was using that disappearance data to help him try to fit stuff, but there was an issue in the 2019 paper. So those disappearance data don't really seem to fit everything else. So we should talk about that, right? I mean, there is another thing there that we didn't mention, which is,
yeah,
if there's one sterile neutrino, why aren't there more sterile neutrinos, right? And in fact, when this cop was looking at the data, this guy's from Fermilab, he didn't think that having just one sterile neutrino fit the bill.
Right, he wanted two.
Yeah, so he thought he needed two to actually fit the data that he had from the LSND and the Mini Boone experiments. Although the later papers seem to think that both of these experiments were not correct in some way, and we shouldn't think about them very hard.
Yeah, Dmitry Naumov does seem to be kind of bearish on the subject based on that disappearance data.
Well, but he still looks at several things. Well, basically, you know, we have the two different ideas here. Like, the appearance data says that if you have a decaying muon, it's going to decay into an electron or a positron plus a electron neutrino plus a mu neutrino.
An anti-mu neutrino, right?
An anti-mu neutrino. Then there's an excess. There's more electron neutrinos than you expect. And that's what they mean by appearance. And this appearance, they're looking at the reactors, and you know, somebody updated the theory, and all of a sudden there were fewer, on the order of 6 to 12% fewer neutrinos than you expected in reactors and in calibration sources and stuff like that. So those are the anomalies that tell you that you probably need this. The cosmological data doesn't really tell you you probably need this, but instead you're trying to use this to explain the cosmological data, right? But the cosmological data seems to be not neutral, but fairly aggressively against anything that anybody thinks up to explain it, at least as far as I can tell.
Because in this paper, I think you're right. In this paper, Sterile Neutrino Short Introduction by Naumov paper, he seems to be pointing at Big Bang nucleosynthesis and the inflationary rate of the universe, how the existence of sterile neutrinos would alter those models significantly, right? I think he said that the universe would expand faster during the inflationary epoch, and it would alter the nucleosynthesis so that we might get different readings on, like, you know, hydrogen isotopes and so forth, or helium isotopes. I can't remember which. But then so that sounded really compelling. Like, okay, yeah, if it's just going to change the entire Big Bang cosmology and give us wrong estimates of the prevalence of isotopes in the early universe, then this can't be right. But then, you know, reading in the role of sterile neutrinos in particle physics paper, it seems like he was saying that because the sterile neutrino isn't going to interact via the weak force, and because of its mass, maybe, he said that it actually wouldn't be detectable. It wouldn't create a detectable influence on the abundances of early isotopes. So they seem to be having two different viewpoints there. Like, that paper seemed to indicate that sterile neutrinos were still allowable within the cosmological data, right? So it's a very controversial area, no doubt.
When I was looking at these papers, there were a lot of them that came out, you know, last week. Even when this gets put up online, there'll still be a lot of them that got put out last week. So people are doing a lot of work in the area and trying to explain things with the sterile neutrinos. And maybe if I had things that were not so ancient, like these two 2019 papers.
2019 is ancient now, huh?
You never know, right? Yeah. Everything could have changed, right? But it's hard to tell because, you know, if you look at the press, everything is brand new and never been done before and all that other stuff. So it's hard to actually use them as a guide to what's going on. Instead, you have to sit around and read a bunch of 50-page papers and see if there's actually anything new in them.
Yeah.
Somebody thought there was something new, at least enough new to publish it. Like the guy was saying, you know, we've got these different experiments or these different things. I think if his estimates of the parameter are on the matrix element, so when these things mix, right, you can talk about it as an angle, but really it's mathematically represented as a matrix that looks like a rotation matrix. It's a unitary matrix. It acts like a rotation matrix. So, you know, if you were measuring something according to a street grid, and then you wanted to switch it over to north, south, east, west sort of thing, you'd have a matrix similar to that. You could use this to rotate the vector components.
And that's how they get the masses, right?
Because that works. You have a mass. If they weren't rotated, rotation isn't a real rotation. What it is it basically gives you the superposition state of the neutrinos.
Oh.
And so that's going to tell you, well, if you have an electron, then you have so much nu 1, so much nu 2, so much nu 3, right? And if you have a muon, you have a different number for each one of those. So each one of the three neutrinos that we see is a different superposition, a different linear combination, a different combination of the three standard model neutrinos.
Did anybody offer any explanation on, I'm confused because how can a sterile neutrino oscillate with active neutrinos? Like, how do you lose the weak force interaction?
I I do not know why that's true, but I think that's just part of the quantum mechanics. You know, the oscillations are sort of part of the quantum mechanics, I think, not part of the interactions. So you're just saying that instead of having three different standard model neutrinos, you have the three standard model neutrinos plus a sterile neutrino or two or seven or however many you decide you need to make this work. You just have an oscillation of more things.
So when you're trying to detect the neutrinos, this is why the disappearance data is so compelling, is you'd expect to be able to detect a certain probability from any reactor or the sun or whatever, but you're seeing a gap, like you're not getting the ratio that you expected. So it looks like you're missing something, right? So to the tune of a few percent. You know, postulate these sterile neutrinos. It's really fascinating.
For the different experiments, that mixing has to be smaller and smaller for different things, right? So for the reactor deficit, the square of the absolute value of the matrix element for the mixing between an electron and the fourth neutrino has to be 0.14. Our friend Naumov said that for cosmological stuff, it sounds to me for all the cosmological stuff, that E4 element has to be very, very small, which means that it just doesn't happen. Right. So to explain this stuff in the early universe, basically, you know, the Big Bang nucleosynthesis stuff,
the recombination epoch.
Yeah. And the cosmic microwave background and all that other stuff. If you're trying to explain those things, then that mixing element has to be very, very small, basically to the point where it almost never happens that the neutrino will turn into the sterile neutrino for a while. So that's a little bit weird for two different regimes. Actually, for multiple regimes, but these are the largest and the smallest of the different regimes for that.
Yeah, and he was saying that the cosmological arguments disfavor additional like sterile neutrinos with masses larger than like 0.3 electron volts.
That's right. So those would be on the order of these other neutrinos. And that also means that they'd be oscillating a lot with them. So, you know, it's starting to get to a point where it doesn't look like it's a completely coherent idea. But like I said, there are a lot of people working on it. Maybe there's a way to put it all together.
Yeah, this is such a challenging area because they were running those experiments at Los Alamos National Lab for like 5 years and they got like 90 detections of neutrinos over that period. We were used to thinking about, you know, the billions of collisions they have per second or whatever at the Large Hadron Collider. So, yeah, they were working with such limited data. And it's such a nascent field of exploration that, you know, there's all kinds of experimental errors in there that we might not be able to see, right?
Possibly. I think they do a pretty good job of things.
Yeah, because they've got all these cross sections and everything worked out. But still, the data is so limited, right? Like, it's so hard to get detections. If you could get a few billion detections, then it would be a lot easier to analyze this statistically and get higher confidence. But I did notice that they're talking about like 3 sigma confidence level that there's another neutrino, right, in this mix at least. But then they said that if you combine the data from one experiment and a completely different experiment, and I don't know if that's legitimate. Can you do that? Can you combine data? Then they said that it was like a 6 sigma confidence level for the existence of another type of neutrino. And then that kind of sets you back on your heels. You're like, shit, well, 5 is the standard, right?
Yeah, I think that was the whole point of what Kopp was doing, right?
Yeah. That's right.
On the other hand, you know, those fits weren't so great. And then when you look at sort of the ranges where these things could actually be, they're pretty small, right? I mean, they're pretty small and they're not really finding things there. So it's a little bit worrying to think about it that way. And again, the data are not all consistent where it would be. So you look at this kind of experiment, it's okay over that. It doesn't work at all. So they have very specific ranges, but as far as I know, they haven't really found anything there. And sometimes some of these lines where they say the things have been crossed off still kind of close to it. So, I mean, possibly there's something there, but the data doesn't look really compelling, although, I mean, obviously they think it is. Or maybe they just want to be the first one to predict it, just in case.
Well, I don't know. I mean, those discrepancies, I mean, like you said, I mean, when you've got discrepancies on the order of like, you know, 5 to 12 or 13% or whatever, that's pretty significant. I mean, even though we are working with limited numbers of detections, they've been doing it for a long time, right? And they do have a good handle on how often those weak interactions happen with the particles in their chamber, and they can detect that, and they know these are top quantum physicists figuring out these experiments, that's still a very significant finding. There's something going on there that they can't explain.
I mean, the big significance about this is not so much the explanation. I mean, the explanation's interesting, but I don't really understand why there wouldn't be something else. Plus, the line with the data pretty much says there's no more neutrino, except you just say, well, then it doesn't interact with anything. It's a neutrino that doesn't interact with the W and Z particles. But the discrepancies look important enough to be one of these things where you think it's going to be one of these places where the standard model is going to break down.
Right. I guess that's why they're pressing into it, because that's our first exciting light for new standard model physics, right? Beyond standard model physics.
Yeah, there aren't very many places where it looks like there are problems with the standard model. I mean, we talked about X17 a couple episodes ago. There's this, and there's one other thing.
I have to say, though, I did lose a lot of my excitement about the X17 findings when I did some further reading and found out that apparently that same lab has been predicting this kind of particle on multiple occasions before over a period of like 10 or 20 years, and they were wrong.
On the other hand, the sterile neutrino, this X17, you know, what they're seeing is saying that there's something wrong with the standard model. The ideas that they have might not be the right ideas, but what they're seeing is probably significant.
Yeah, and that's more than we've gotten from the freaking multi-billion dollar Large Hadron Collider, which only really confirmed the Higgs boson and everything else.
Yeah, in a lot of places we just see confirmations, and that's nice, it's useful, but it's just confirming what seems to have been true already.
Yeah, pretty well trodden since, what, the 70s or 60s?
You know, the standard model's complex enough, but, I mean, the places where it breaks down is where there's going to be new fundamental physics for the people who do that, because otherwise they're going to get really bored.
Did they have to make a modification to the standard model when they found neutrino oscillations?
I don't know how much they had to change it. I think what happened is they sort of changed what they meant by an electron neutrino, right, to be this mix of the standard model neutrinos.
Okay, so it was a pretty minor modification then in order to accommodate that. Because I do remember they were surprised by it, so it wasn't predicted by the standard model.
No, maybe not. But they were able to cobble it in, I guess. Seems to be good enough.
That's kind of an exciting thing, because if they had to modify the standard model a little bit once for neutrinos, maybe they have to do it again.
I mean, if there's actually anything to this.
Yeah. Well, was there anything else in these papers you wanted to touch on, Jim?
I think that's everything. I mean, for the last one, the rules paper, I only read it once and saw it pretty quick. So let's see. No, I don't see anything except for notes telling me to look up other things to see what the hell they were talking about.
I have to say, though, that I was really impressed when I was reading about how this all came about, right? How the sterile neutrino idea started to emerge in the disappearance data and all that. And Fermilab built a special detector, neutrino detector, in order to test those results with equipment tailor-made for that exploration, and that was the mini boon. And now they're working on the micro boon, right? So it's cool that they're building customized detectors to explore these very questions. I'm more excited about these kind of tailor-made experiments to answer certain, you know, empirically driven questions that come up than I am about just building a bigger collider.
You know, some places they can't build a bigger collider, right? Like in the middle of Chicago.
Sure. And they're not cheap either. You can't go building, increasing your order of magnitude collision energies, every year. It's a real expensive way to go. But these are cool because they're less expensive and they're looking to answer a specific question which came up, you know.
Okay, so apparently I do have a note here that says that the right-handed neutrinos, right, still interact with the left-handed neutrinos and the Higgs particle via the Yukawa interactions. So it's saying something about the form of the interactions, basically saying that somehow they are pulling the energy out of the vacuum expectation value of the Higgs field.
Okay, so the active and the sterile neutrinos, which are the left-handed and right-handed neutrinos, they do interact, but it's mediated by this Higgs field.
Cool. Well, I'm not sure. The way I wrote it down, it sounds like they both interact with a Yukawa-type interaction, but it doesn't say exactly where that comes from.
Okay.
That's the way I wrote it down in my notes.
The Yukawa potential, that plays a big role in the strong force, right?
Yeah.
So when are you going to get your name on one of these equations, Jim?
I think it's a little late. If I was going to do that, I would have done it in my 20s.
Is that what Yukawa was? He was some, you know, upstart like MIT grad or something. I'm 25. I'm going to revolutionize physics with this equation.
I don't know. Let's see. He was born in 1907. So probably not.
Right. He was like our age. Well, no, he's probably in his, like, 40 or something, right? Oh, geez, he was in the 30s. So
yeah, he was in his 20s.
Nice.
It was, so, yeah, it's too late. Have to start early. Remember that next life.
So you got to give up all the good stuff when you're like a teenager and a young adult in order to make your breakthrough, and then you can, I guess, party. I should have put that, backwards in my life.
Yeah, I don't think it works that way. I think if you miss out on your 20s, you never get them back. I
mean, yeah.
Unless you move to New Orleans. I guess I've seen a couple of guys in New Orleans try that.
Yeah. At Burning Man, too, you'll see some of that.
Oh, okay. Well, that's another reason to stay away from Burning Man.
Got it all hanging out, baby. All right, Jim, thank you so much for going over all this with me. It's a really intriguing thing. I mean, there's definitely something needs explaining here. We just, sterile neutrinos might be the way to go, or maybe there's something even weirder going on with neutrinos that we don't know yet.
There must be something weirder going on with neutrinos.
Well, there's something weird happening, right? Because they can't explain away those discrepancies, right?
Doesn't matter how big a hole you dig under South Dakota, you still can't find enough of them to figure out what the hell's going on.
Or Antarctica. Like, you've seen the ice cube, right?
I've never been there, no.
Well, I mean, I've seen photos, right? They made this gigantic neutrino detector under the ice, you know? It's crazy.
That's a good place for it. Not going to get very many visitors, though.
I'd love to see it, but there's just no freaking way I want to go into the freaking Antarctic.
Yeah, that's another thing you missed out on. I did have a friend who decided to go down there.
Oh, yeah? What, Murdoch Station or something?
Yeah, I don't remember. I just remember he decided, I'm going to take 6 months out of my life and live in Antarctica.
Jesus.
I don't know why he decided that. But then I never saw him again, so.
Do you know if he made it back?
Well, I don't even know if he made it there.
Okay.
Was there an internet at that point?
It was the ARPANET back then or something, huh?
Man, that was a long time ago. That was probably 94 or so with the people I was hanging out with. All right. Well, that is a wrap.
All right, Jim. You have a great week.
Oh, you want to do this in a week?
Yeah, absolutely. We got the pandemic vacation going on, so let's make use of it. Remain sterile, disinfect your groceries, and you know, we'll make it till next week, and we'll do another one then.
That's a horrible thing to say to a man. I know. I'll talk to you later, Rick.
All right, be well, friend.
Okay, bye now. Bye. You have just listened to episode number 52 of Physics Frontiers, Sterile Neutrinos. Show notes for this episode can be found at frontiers.physicsfm.com/52. Show notes include the papers we read for this program, as well as related episodes of Physics Frontiers. Thank you very much for listening, and good night.